Okay. You're sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin. None of you are old enough for that one. Dhamma dinner is. So we are looking at what we really know. And yesterday we were looking at our two principal modes of knowledge. That is knowledge through perception and knowledge through conception. And I hope that what we came away with was an idea of what they could tell us and an idea of what they can't tell us. We saw that knowledge through perception is knowledge of representation. It's not knowledge of things, it's knowledge of our mental construction based on the information that we're getting. Of what, we don't know. Because what we know through perception is the representation, the image, the picture that presents itself in our consciousness, that in a way is our consciousness. And then we saw that knowledge through conception is in a sense even more remote, because what a concept is a representation of a representation. Our concepts are constructed out of our empirical experience, our perceptual experience, generalized from them, abstracted from them, and then first of all used to describe our perceptual experience, and then used to reflect upon it and to arrange it into patterns and categories and so forth, becoming possibly extremely abstract, particularly in physics and mathematics, capable of extreme degrees of abstraction. And of course, the more abstract, the more remote from direct perceptual experience. But all conception originates in perception, in representation through perception, and returns to it. It doesn't take us beyond what is represented. It's very important. So I hope that we're all reasonably clear about that, and I did suggest that you try to reflect upon it and examine your own direct experience in the course of the last day. I don't know what results you had. It's quite difficult to do, actually, because as you probably saw in the exercise we did just now, your mind immediately constructs experience. I was asking you to attend to what I think is probably the whispering of the air conditioning. How quickly did your mind start to say, it's this, it's that, and to do so in a very concrete way, so that you actually think what you are hearing is the air conditioning. Actually, what you're hearing is a representation, which, you know, from the point of view of our constructed world, we call an air conditioning system. But what it actually is, we don't really know. So the question we're going to try to nudge into tonight, taking my life in my hands, is what is it that the representations are representations of? Well, the first thing we must say is that, of course, we can't say. We've got to say that we can't say. Because as soon as we start to speak about it, we're imposing upon what is not a representation or a conception, language derived from representation and formed on the basis of concepts. So we're hamstrung from the start. We can't speak about what is not representation or conception because our language is derived from representation and conception. Okay, end of evening. No, I've still got a rabbit or two to pull out of the hat, or rather I'm borrowing some from Schopenhauer and from the great Buddhist tradition. So we do know a few things in terms of representation and conception about what is not representation and conception. Well, that gives the game away, doesn't it? We know that it's not representation or conception. And negative knowledge, in a certain sense, is knowledge. So we do know that what is not representation, what representation is, so to speak, representation of what in Kant and Schopenhauer's language is the thing in itself that is represented, we do know that it is not it's not representation. We know that it's not conception. And that tells us quite a lot in a mystifying sort of way. For instance, it tells us that the thing in itself, reality beyond representation and conception, it tells us that it's not subject-object, it's neither subject nor object. Because I hope what we saw yesterday, what I tried to show yesterday, was that subject and object are part of representation. They're part of the way in which we represent reality to ourselves. We are part of the way we represent reality to ourselves, if you see what I mean. So reality, the thing in itself, what is beyond conception and representation, cannot be either subject or object. I hope you can't follow me, because there's, in a sense, nothing to follow. What I'm doing is leading you to the edge of a precipice and then pushing you off, jumping off myself with you. So that's the first thing we know about it. Then we know that it's not to do with time or space, because time and space are part of the way we represent reality to ourselves. This was the great insight of Kant, which Schopenhauer built upon, and which I claim is the fact that he saw that is the reason why we can be Western Buddhists, because we recognise that the world is not a solid entity existing out there constructed by God, but that it is a construction. Time and space are not outside consciousness, with consciousness sort of inserted into them, but they're part of the structure through which consciousness interprets reality. This is a biggie. We think of ourselves as I say, inserted inside a sort of fixed framework of space and time. But actually, space and time are part of the way we interpret whatever data we are receiving, to use that framework. Do you see what I mean? This takes some working with. But if space and time are part of the way we represent reality to ourselves, reality itself cannot be bounded by space and time. This gets pretty strange, doesn't it? Because with space, we've got coordinates, we've got distribution externally, internally, left, right, north, south, up, down. All of that is construction. Even more freaky is that the flow of time is something we interpret experience through. And the coordinates of space and time enable us to divide the world. They enable us to create multiplicity out of a reality that implicitly is an undifferentiated flow, to use that way of thinking about it. Do you see what I mean? So that reality itself is not susceptible of number. You can't even, strictly speaking, say that it's one, unitary. This is why in some schools of Buddhist philosophy, they speak about reality, to put that term, non-Buddhist term, upon it, is not two. It's not that it's one, it's not two. Because even the idea of unitary implies number, if you see what I mean. So reality itself is neither one nor two. It's not partite. It's not divided up. You know, I'm able to experience this room, you likewise, full of you. however many there are of you, 50, 60, 70 of you, I'm able to differentiate you from one from another and to count you because I'm interpreting my experience right now in terms of space and time. I'm imposing space and time upon the thing in itself, to use that term, and counting it. But the imposition of space and time follows on from reality. It's not that reality exists within space and time. Space and time exists within reality. It's not that my consciousness exists within space and time. Space and time exist within consciousness. You get some experience of this in states where space and time behave differently, if you see what I mean. Perhaps you've had experiences where space and time stop altogether or disintegrate altogether, but probably most people have had experiences of space and time as behaving in odd ways. I won't start talking about the 60s and ingesting certain substances, but that's a very clear example, the way in which space and time, you know, space can just sort of collapse and become meaningless almost, and time can flow in all sorts of directions or not at all. You're getting some intuition of the fact that space and time are construction because you're fiddling with the mechanism that does the constructing, so it doesn't happen sort of efficiently. And in meditative states, space and time can behave very strangely indeed. In fact, traditionally it's said that in very very intense, concentrated, subtle states of mind, time expands vastly. So you can have that sort of experience of time, you know, moving in all sorts of different ways, and even space moving in different ways. But of course, those are only within still the framework of space and time, but there's space and time beginning to fray at the edges, so to speak. So, do you see where we've got to? It's a bit weird, isn't it? The information that our perceptual information is representation. Representation is constructed within the framework of subject and object, here, there. It's constructed within the framework of space and time. It's multiform because of space and time. It's split up and divided. But all of that is added on to raw reality, to use a rather strange phrase. So reality itself is not bounded by space and time. Of course, in the Buddhist tradition, this is in Mahayana philosophy referred to under the heading of shunyata, which literally means emptiness. The modern Hindi, Marathi, and North Indian languages term for naught in counting is shunya. So you'll hear your airplane call shunya shunya dos, 002. Which, of course, as a good Buddhist, freaks me out. But it just means nothing, a zero. So shunyata, ta is a suffix that makes an abstract noun. So it's nothingness. It is ness. Ta means ness, if you see what I mean. Or iti. Shunyata means literally emptiness, nothingness. But what is implied by that is not mere vacuity. It's really the term shunya is first used in the early Buddhism to indicate emptiness of something particular, emptiness particularly of desire, the lack of desire. But it comes to mean reality beyond perception and conception. It means what, as it were, is constructed, to use that language, in terms of perception and conception, in terms of representation and representation of representation. So we've, through the language of our ordinary knowledge, knowledge through perception and knowledge through conception, we've arrived at least at a negative knowledge of what reality itself is, what the thing in itself is, in Kantian and Schopenhauerian terms. So are we able to go any further? Kant was quite clear that we couldn't. And his great contribution was to show the limitations of the abuse of reason. He thought that many of his predecessors, especially the rationalist philosophers, had overused reason and thought that they'd arrived at an understanding of things through reason. And he showed that they couldn't. But he said, that's it. He said, fortunately, by a rather sophistic arguments, which I'm not entirely convinced by, that fortunately our representations actually are representations of the way things are. It doesn't entirely work, in my opinion, but maybe I'm not enough of a Kantian, and he's ferociously difficult to understand. He's the most subtle and far-reaching thinker I've ever encountered. Schopenhauer said that's wrong, and I think this is a good contribution for us. He said that, yes, we don't, through perception and conception, get access to reality, but we do have, all of us, one way of experiencing beyond representation. So usually, you know, we see something out there and we have to recognize that's a representation. We don't know what it's a representation of. We don't know what the thing in itself is. But he said there's one thing to which we do have immediate access. What he called, we have immediate consciousness of one thing, and that is of our own body. My body, seen from the outside, seen as it were from through visual perception, is a representation. I hold up my hand, and in looking at my hand, it'd be the same for you, by the way, looking at my hand, I'm representing it to me. This isn't, you know, it seems to be my veritable hand, but it's only a representation that I'm seeing, that I'm then conceptualizing in terms of hand, and then further conceptualizing in terms of its relationship to a body, and so on and so forth. So in through the visual sense and through most of the senses, I have access only to the representation of my own body. But I do have another access to my own body. And it's not the kinesthetic sense. I think this is an easy misreading of what he's saying. It's not the internal feeling of where my hand is and so forth, which is just another sense, just another means of representing. He described it as, he talked of it as having access to will. Our will. So when I move my arm, I can see it. I'm representing the movement of my arm to myself, which is just representation. And then if I call it an arm, I'm conceptualizing about it. If I then start to ratiocinate about it, I'm conceptualizing about that labeling. But at the same time, I'm conscious of a movement taking place. I don't mean, again, the kinesthetic consciousness of it. I'm conscious of, as it were, something directing my hand, something moving it. I'm conscious of something, as it were, internal, to use the language of space, that is directing my hand. Of course, I can then think about that in terms of the language of conception and representation and conception. I can talk about my motive. I'm reaching out my hand and waving it around in order to illustrate to you the internal dimension. But Schopenhauer said, no, that is simply an explanation in terms of space and time. That isn't will. That's what he called motivation. What he meant by will was something much, much more mysterious. He meant the distant sense that something is directing the movement of your body, the actions of your body in space and time. Something that, as it were, stands outside the process of space and time, is moving you within space and time. It's quite difficult to get at, particularly because he uses the term will, which we naturally think of in terms of motivation in the normal sense, that I want to achieve that, I want to do that. He's not talking about that. He's talking about something more inchoate, less formed, less thinkable, but which we do have a sense of. I'll give you a little example. I did a long solitary retreat a few years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and I was alone for a long time, so I began to do rather weird things. I won't tell you all of them. But one of the things I became fascinated with was, why do anything? Well, I'm fascinated for very good reasons, because I couldn't see particularly good reasons for doing anything at some point, particularly getting out of bed. I know everybody's had this feeling, but I just couldn't see how I got out of bed. I don't mean, you know, I knew how to, the mechanics of it, but I didn't sort of really work out what got me out of bed. And I remember one morning, I think it was about 12 o'clock, when I suddenly found myself in the toilet having a pee. And I didn't really know how I got there. I just went. I needed a pee, so I went. But we have the idea that I am up here telling my body what to do. But if you examine very closely what goes on, it's not really like that. There's a mysterious internal upsurging, which we're dimly conscious of. We sense the motivation, as in to say, the moving force arising within us. We then apply to that motives in the terms of space and time. But it's sort of, if you look at it closely, it's not itself determinable. Determinable in the philosophical sense of making determinate, of seeing it as a something. It seems, Schopenhauer said, simply to emerge, and it refuses the question, where do you come from? Why did you do it? It's mute. It's what he called occultum mysterium, the mysterious obscurity, the mysterious occultation, what you cannot go beyond. I don't know whether you've really got this, and it may take some time to sort of reflect on and look at more deeply, but what it requires, and perhaps this is the exercise that we can be trying over the next 24 hours, is it requires a close examination of what happens when we move or do something, or even don't move. What happens? Where does it come from? What Schopenhauer argued, and I this is certainly my own experience when I've been able to attend closely enough, is it comes, as it were, out of something beyond what one can determine in terms of representation and conception. So Schopenhauer's next step was to say that because we've got at least immediate consciousness of this will stirring within us, moving within us, we can make a pretty good guess that it's the same force, so to speak, force, of course, used metaphorically here, because it's not a force in terms of the laws of causation and space and time, but it's the same force moving through everything else. This is what Dylan Thomas was getting at, that the force that through the green fuse drives the flower drives my green age. And he was a Schopenhauerian. He read Schopenhauer, as did Thomas Hardy, by the way. The Dynast is his attempt at a Schopenhauerian explanation of things, or a account of things. But Schopenhauer says that in everything, something is moving. Again, I'm using the language drawn from space and time, from representation and conception, so it must be wrong. But it gets us a little bit closer to things. So he's saying, first of all, analogically, because within me, I'm immediately conscious of will, it must be will that is the inner dimension of everything. And that will cannot be different from my will, as it were, my will, because it's not my will, it's the will as it emerges in me. Because we've already seen that will, that the thing in itself, that reality itself, is beyond space and time, is beyond number. So it cannot be, as it were, a separate force animating everything else from the inside. It cannot be, the thing in itself cannot be, as it were, a separate thing for each thing, if you see what I mean. That you've got your thing in itself and I've got my thing in itself. And hands off. It cannot be like that because the thing in itself is not susceptible to number. Shunyata is impartite. It is not, to mix my universities of discourse, legitimately, I think. It cannot be subject to number. So he's saying, if I know it in me as will, this force that moves my arm, gets me up in the morning, etc., etc., from the inside, not from outside circumstances and explanations and motives, if that is what is I am immediately conscious of, and what I am immediately conscious of is something that is not representation and conception, then it must be free from division. This is a logical argument, and perhaps one might find it difficult to follow easily. But then he argues that that must be what moves, as it were, in everything. Now, you don't necessarily have to have got this or even to buy it. I think it is very useful reflection, and it's worth spending some time looking at motivation, separating out in the situation motivation that is to do with representation and conception, and trying to look at the inner dynamic. You know, you're constrained all the time to fall back on language drawn from representation and conception. But fortunately, we're not just left there. If we were just left there, you'd either sort of get it or you wouldn't, or you'd buy it or you wouldn't buy it. But Schopenhauer says that we've got other means of access to the thing in itself. And we've got other ways of at least approaching it more closely and more intimately. These, I think, are a bit more within our ken. The first of these is aesthetic experience. And really, Schopenhauer is formative for the whole Western aesthetic theory. Schopenhauer himself is very much neglected as a philosopher. I studied philosophy for my degree, first degree, and we never even mentioned Schopenhauer. He was not considered a proper philosopher. And when you read Schopenhauer, you can see why, because he spends a lot of time slagging off philosophers. So professional academic philosophers aren't very keen on this. And because he does strike into what you might call the realms of religion. I remember we were discouraged from studying Eastern philosophy because we were told it would get us emotionally engaged. I did try to say I want to be emotionally engaged. It was the worst days of analytic philosophy. It was a long time ago, I assure you. I'm sure it's better now. So Schopenhauer says that we've got access, or at least a sort of an approach to the thing in itself through aesthetic experience. So what I think of here is what I call the gallery experience. You go to a picture gallery. It can happen with any of the arts, of course, whatever your own favourite is. You go to a picture gallery and you start looking at paintings. I don't get the chance very often, and it's not, you know, my strongest suit. But I always find that to begin with, I don't quite know what to do with myself. I've learnt that the first thing to do is have a bit of a wander around and then a cup of tea. It's extremely important in aesthetic experience. And then choose what to go and look at. And don't try and see everything. So you go and look at something. And to begin with, you're sort of looking at it, saying, oh, that's yellow, that's green, that's blue, that's pink. And there's a certain point, if you get in the groove, when suddenly you enter into the painting. And you become absorbed. You become absorbed in the painting. It can happen with music, can't it? You go to hear a concert, and to begin with, you're thinking about this and thinking about that, and the person next to you is scrunching something, and you know, there's this and that and the other, and you're distracted by the hall or whatever. At a certain point, the music takes you by the shirt and pulls you into it. Whatever the medium is, it can happen. Dance, anything. It can be a landscape too. You're just sort of looking around and sort of thinking, where am I? And then suddenly you're entranced. You're in the spell, as it were. So what actually happens in that situation? What's going on? What's the transition when you move from a fairly ordinary representation of the world, distributed in space and time with me and self and other and so forth, with conceptualization going on and explanation of what it is and account of all the different things and so on. What happens when you move from that into aesthetic entrancement? Well, what Schopenhauer says is that you cease to see the thing, see the object or hear the object or whatever, within the framework of space and time. It goes further than that. I haven't explained a lot of Schopenhauer's philosophy, sparing you, because it's not an account of his philosophy. This is my attempt to understand our experience, strongly drawn by that, drawing on that. But he says that you experience the object outside the principle of sufficient reason. What that means is that you experience it outside explanation, outside the world of causes and effects. You experience it not as something having a place in a sequence, as being the prelude to something else and the coda to something prior. You cease to place it within space and time. Or rather, you still place it within space, of course, because it's out there. If it's a visual object or even a sound object, it's out there. So it's within space. But time, to a greater or lesser extent, begins to disappear. The framework of time disappears. For a little while, you're entranced, and in that entrancement, time stands still. To some extent, depends on the extent of your engagement, depends on the adequacy of the object, because some objects are better at grabbing you than others. Every object can grab you if you have a true aesthetic awareness, as it were. Everything is capable of being perceived in this way. But some things, for various formal reasons, which we're not going to be looking at today, are more easy to approach than others and invite you more than others. You know, what we call great art is art that more readily gives you access to this timeless, a-causal experience. You're not interested in what it is, you're not interested in why it is, you're simply interested in that it is, in its hikicity. You're interested in the fact that it is there, not what, why it is, which is a question about where it came from, or what it is, which is a question about its construction, so to speak. You're neither interested in its etiology nor its makeup, construction. You're simply interested in, or you're absorbed in, the fact that it is. So it ceases to be a representation within a field of representation, within a field of representation governed by causality, governed by time. Space is still there, otherwise there couldn't be a representation, if you see what I mean. Because it has to be you here and the thing there. But space, even space, can become highly attenuated. And very, very interesting, I've never really got on with this sort of modernist music, the minimalist music, for instance, but a friend took me to a concert of Stephen Reich, his music, and he told me what to do, as it were, where to put my ear. And you don't put your ear on the notes, you put your ear on between the notes. And what happens is you start to hear something that isn't there, emerging from the relationship of the notes. And it's extraordinarily satisfying and extraordinarily absorbing, because the notes exist in relation to each other. I remember hearing one piece where a violin played a sequence of notes. You couldn't call it even a theme exactly, but a sequence of notes. And then that was recorded and played back slightly slower than the tempo at which the main recording, the main instrument was playing. And slowly, as they spread apart, a different sound emerged from between them. And the sensation was very strange indeed. The sensation was of moving into a different mode of consciousness, where you were hearing something that wasn't there, but that was perfectly audible, and that was non-teleological. You know, in the most classical music, most Western classical music, is teleological. It's got it's a narrative, and it has a story to tell, as it were. It begins here and it ends there, and the satisfaction is in the growing sort of tensions and then their resolution. You know, jump in a very amateur way over a large subject. But in this sort of music, and it's the same a little bit with Indian music, it's not really about going anywhere. It's simply about the particular notes emerging at a particular time. And you're drawn into them and you lose your ordinary sense of representation, your ordinary sense of time and even of space. So that's what happens to the object. The object in your experience is freed from the tyranny of time to a greater or lesser extent. And the object is, to a greater or lesser extent, freed from the tyranny of causality. It ceases to exist for you as something that has arisen in dependence on something else. It ceases to arise for you as the gateway to something following after it. It exists purely for itself, for you, at that moment. Somebody standing next to you won't see that or hear that. But what's really interesting is what happens to you. Because there's correlative with the change in the object is a change in the subject, as there always must be. Subject and object are correlative. They exist together. They're not separate. They're simply two sides, two facets of the same representational moment. So something happens to the subject as well as to the object. What happens to the subject is that you become, according to Schopenhauer, and I think this is a good way of speaking of it, you become for a while freed from will. You become free from, you know, in classic Buddhist terms, desire. You are no longer driven. You become the pure, will-less subject of knowledge. For a little while, you are not going anywhere. You're not striving for something. You're not hungry. One of the great Buddhist commentators I've been reading recently, Asanga, says that the mind is always hungry. The mind is always hungry for experience. Like when I was getting you to listen to the whispering sound of the what we now laughingly call the air conditioning system. You know, stepping into the pure, such a crude world of representation. I've lost my thread now. our mind is hungry to identify it. It almost can't bear just the purity of that sound. You have to know what it is. But in aesthetic experience, the mind's hunger is for a while appeased. And you become yourself free from the tyranny of will. The tyranny of will that drives everything. That drives the world outside you, drives the world inside you. You become suspended from that. You become free from that. You float free from it. Of course, you're not interested in thinking about that at the time, because you're simply absorbed in that moment of experience. You're absorbed in the experience of the object as fact, rather than as an incident, if you see what I mean. You're absorbed in the that-ness of the object, rather than the why or the how of it. And you yourself are freed from all sense of drive in relation to it. Usually what happens when we see anything is that we evaluate it in terms of its pleasure or pain for us, in terms of its benefit or threat to us. That's what will drives us to do within us. The force within us drives us to protect ourselves and to gain what will fulfill us, as it were. This is Trishna. But that's suspended. You don't want anything. And the experience, if it's at all intense, aesthetic experience, if it's at all intense, is of not needing anything, not wanting anything, at least to some extent. Of course, we don't often experience it at its absolute peak. But for a little while, we're freed from that tyranny. And for a little while, we're just sort of satisfied and delighted. And we experience, if we sort of analyse it, a kind of relief. That's what the joy of aesthetic experience is. That, first of all, the object itself is so pleasing because it is not demanding of us. It's simply there, pure, satisfying. All its qualities are exposed to us. Schopenhauer has a very intricate argument or discussion about what that is based on Plato's ideas, but I won't go there. But the object is revealed in its purity, if you like, freed from cause, freed from time, and is therefore pleasing in itself. And the more adequate the object, the more great the art, or the more satisfying the scene or whatever, the more deeply pleasing it is. But there's a corresponding inner pleasure, and the pleasure is the freedom, relief from that from the intense pressure of will that is driving us all the time, that is moving us through life all the time, that is never satisfied. always hungry, always wanting more, always afraid, always defensive, always offensive, always hopeful, and so on, but is never at peace. But for a while, we know peace in the aesthetic experience. For a little while, we're suspended from that. And you can know that experience, you know, if you're in the middle of quite a lot of trouble of some kind or other, some mental suffering or some difficulty in your life or whatever, and you do have the fortune to have some kind of aesthetic revelation. You know, suddenly something catches you. Afterwards, you sort of, you feel completely different. You're cleaned out. The previous state of anxiety or suffering or pain is for a while alleviated. So aesthetic experience, according to Schopenhauer, and I think this is what we will find if we examine it quite closely, takes us a little way beyond the subject-object framework. And it takes us a little bit beyond the spatio-temporal framework. Space is still there, but very, very attenuated. Time, the greater the aesthetic experience, the more time is suspended. So we have a little bit of an experience of the sort of threshold of reality itself. We're taken right up to it. And it's because it's... Less differentiated in terms of the coordinates of self and other and the coordinates of space and time, it's more adequate to reality itself. Reality represents itself in the aesthetic object more fully and completely than it does in the ordinary object. Do you see what I mean? So that when we see anything, through the ordinary eye, which is dominated by space and time, dominated by self and other, we're seeing a highly refracted and distorted and even, you might say, alienated version of reality. It's very useful for breakfast and survival and so forth, but it's a very distant reflection of the way things really are. When we have aesthetic experience, we come very close to the way things really are. We're not there, unless we really sort of pass through the gateway through aesthetic experience. And you can do. That is certainly a Buddhist tradition, that there's the gateway of beauty, Shubha Vimoksha Mukha. You can enter reality through beauty, which means through suspension of space, time, self, and other in aesthetic experience. So we get very close to what the thing in itself is in this way. We begin to sense something that is beyond its construction in terms of representation, its construction in terms of conception, and so on. Now, if that was the only means of access we had, perhaps it doesn't reveal enough about what reality is. Unfortunately, we have another mode of access, according to Schopenhauer, which is in what you might call ethical experience. So in ethical experience, you sense... And you sense it immediately, the life in another, in pure ethical experience. I don't mean in ethics according to commandment, if you see what I mean. It's not ethics according to rule. It's the ethics of the moment when you know you cannot do that because it will cause harm. I remember a wonderful story that a Mitra... who came to the LBC when I was chair here, which is before the flood. He was an Irishman, and as a young man, he was quite a bit older than me, so that's going back some, he'd been inducted into the IRA. as you know was traditional in his from his background. And after being inducted to the IRA, he was taken on a raid, and you know, he'd never fired a rifle before, so they showed him which end to point and which where to point pull the trigger, and he was left as a sort of rear guard. But they'd been betrayed, and the British soldiers were waiting, and he suddenly found himself at the wrong end of a soldier's rifle, and his own rifle was pointing in the right direction, and he said their two guns were pointing at each other, and they looked at each other. They weren't that far apart. He could see that the soldier was absolutely terrified. He could see that he was absolutely terrified, and he could see that the soldier saw he was absolutely terrified, and he could see that both of them were sort of frozen. They couldn't shoot. They couldn't shoot because they could see humanity in the other. Of course, he hadn't been trained. The soldier had. And he shot, and he, in illustration, he pulled down his shirt and showed me a bullet hole through his shoulder. But the point is, well, one point, of course, is that military training is dangerous. a lack of military training is even more dangerous. But what I found really striking, really moving about his account was his, that ethical moment, which was not mediated by thought or an idea or a commandment, because he was an Irish nationalist. It was his duty to incorporate the six counties. But his absolutely immediate, natural human response to the life in another. That is what I mean by the ethical sensitivity, that other way we have of having access to the thing in itself. We have access to it through our immediate intuition of life, which we sense is the same life. That's what he said, I remember that, Desmond Fitzgerald. He wouldn't be an Irishman, would he? What he said was that he could see that they'd seen that they were the same as each other. He could see that shooting that soldier would have been shooting himself. He could see that the soldier saw that shooting him would be shooting himself. That is what Schopenhauer's talking about. This ethical sensitivity, which is nothing to do with formal rules of ethics. Well, no, it's not nothing to do with them, because formal rules of ethics can help us to get in contact with that immediate natural sensitivity. It's not to do with obeying rules. It's to do with discovering our immediate sensitivity to the life around us. But of course, the life that we're most sensitive to is the life that's most like our own. That's the life in other humans. But we can be as sensitive to the life in animals, in plant life, even in inanimate objects, in rocks and so forth. We can have a sense of our identity with them, which is really very mysterious, isn't it, when it strikes upon you. I remember that in my solitary retreat, because I was on my own, nobody to talk to, apart from the long conversations I had with people who'd offended me in the past, and in which I would tell them what I thought and then get upset by their answer that they hadn't actually given. Become incredibly sensitive to the life in everything around you. Everything. The sheep. Say it for the sheep. The trees, the grass, the mountains. Extraordinarily alive. The same life as me. Yes, my life, as it were, manifests life to a higher, manifestation, degree of manifestation. But it's the same life. And so what Schopenhauer gets at, and which I think we can begin to reflect upon further tomorrow, is that we have a different way of knowing the world.
We have a different way of knowing the world, knowing not the world, and not knowing the world as representation, knowing the world as what Schopenhauer called the world as will. We have a different way of knowing reality, which is not through perception, representation of perception. It's not through concepts, representations of representations. It's directly through this immediate consciousness of a life, the life force within us, our sense of transcending the tyranny of our world as representation in aesthetic experience, and our immediate consciousness of the life in others. It's not, pathetic fallacy, as it were. It's not simply projecting my life into another life. Of course, that's part of it, but it's an immediate sensitivity to it, an immediate feeling of it, which can become very intense indeed. You can feel the energy of others very intensely. For instance, in a strong retreat, if you're very deeply in retreat and perhaps in silence, you can begin to feel the life in others. You can feel what's going on inside them, even in sort of specifics. You know what they're thinking about. Without thinking about it, you know it. But it's more to do with feeling the life. So tomorrow I want to see if I've got any, I can go any further with this, because I think this is exceptionally important for us, that we have perception through perception, which is perception within the world of representation, which has its limitations. It's great, it's very valuable, and actually it can be, through aesthetic experience, a gateway to something else. But it's limited, and what it presents to us through our in our original disposition of mind, is actually quite a large falsification of reality. We have, through aesthetic experience, some access more directly to what transcends that. Through our own consciousness, immediate consciousness of the life within us, in terms of what moves us, the sense of the life in our own actions, and through our sense of the life in others, through what you could call ethical sense, empathy, perhaps, would be a better way of putting it. So I'll leave it there and ask you to reflect further upon these three modes, or rather three illustrations of this other mode of knowledge that I've been trying to adumbrate. Knowledge of the inner dimension of our bodies, not in terms of what they feel like on the inside, because that's still representation, but in terms of our sense, our inchoate sense, this mysteria occulta, occulta mysteria, this obscure mystery of something beyond the possibility of representation, beyond the possibility of conception, but that we have an immediate consciousness of in terms of our own life force. This aesthetic moment, when we are freed to a greater or lesser extent from the tyranny of the construction of our experience, and this sensitivity to the world around us through our immediate intuition of the life, especially in other people, but also in other elements of our world. So I'd like you to just sort of play with all of that. I hope you manage to get through the day successfully and don't get run over. But if you do, enjoy it. Tube trains are wonderful for just sort of getting away from your, if you come from my sort of background, your instinctive shutting yourself off from other people and sort of opening up to the life in the train, even in that cold, weird, mechanical world of the underground, opening up to the life in the world around you. So good luck. Let's see where we go tomorrow. I'm sorry I didn't leave time for questions. Maybe tomorrow I feel I haven't got so much to say, but I usually say that. And we'll explore a bit further this faculty, which is not to do with perception, not to do with conception. Thank you.